when you know a book is finished, it's like when you literally know that this is the best I can do. I cannot write anymore. And then you have this other person come in and say, no, you can do this and this and this. So that was work to kind of like push myself to keep changing it beyond what I thought was possible.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is Maisie Card, author of the novel, These Ghosts Are Family, a story that shifts and is shaped by the voices and perspectives of its characters, a work Maisie conceived over the course of 12 years.
I wanted there to be confusion and revision constantly. And so I wrote the stories thinking about that. I think the arrangement is messy and nonlinear because that's how we actually learn about our family. You have to kind of put together like puzzle pieces.
As a Jamaican American, Maisie's fiction includes patois along with the folklore and ghost stories of her youth. She reveals the spooky parallels she began to notice between the fiction she was creating and her life in the world. Plus, why this family story is a collection of all the things she can't say out loud. And how she's managed to stay true to the calling on her life she's known since she was just 16 years old. Get to know Maisie Card next when Black and Published continues. So let's just jump right in. My first question for you is, when did you know that you were a writer?
I knew when I was actually in 10th grade. I think I was like 16 years old. And I'd always been like a huge reader since I was 5. But I don't think I'd ever really tried to write before then, like write something fictional until then. And we had an assignment in class, in English class. And I remember we were reading the Flannery O'Connor story, Everything That Rises Must Converge. And our assignment was to kind of write about a character who doesn't speak in the story. So I wrote from the perspective of one of the Black passengers on the bus. And I kept writing that story and rewriting that story until I got to college, actually. The way it stuck with me, that's when I kind of realized that I was a writer. And also, you know, I think beyond after that point, I kind of made every kind of major life decision based on the fact that I wanted to be a writer. You know, so I chose what college I was going to go to, and then I did the MFA. Like, that kind of set me on the path.
So at 15, you had your whole life figured out?
16, yeah. So not how I was going to survive financially, but yeah.
Oh, we're getting there. Because I was like, yeah. What does that look like? Say, 16, I'm going to be a writer. I'm going to go to a writing school. I'm going to get an MFA. What does that look like in practice?
What I tell, you know, students who ask me, because I work in a high school now, is that, you know, you kind of have to have two careers, I think, when you're a writer. So you always have to think about, like, you know, your ideal career, your dream, you know, your artistic profession, but then you have to think about how you're actually going to make money. So I've been writing, you know, consistently, but I haven't been working as a writer, I think, till very recently.
Why?
I've been writing, but I haven't been making any money till my book sold.
Okay.
That's when I started making money.
Okay. So you've been working at the practice, but not working in a way that shows receipts and dividends. So how long did it take you to write your debut novel?
I think from start to finish, it probably took me about 12 years. I don't know like whether to count the first few years because I didn't know I was writing a novel. You know, it wasn't what I set out to do. But I think I officially, you know, started these stories that would become part of the novel when I was in the Brooklyn College MFA program, which was 2006. And for a long time, I just thought of it as writing. I was just working on individual short stories that were based on family stories or memories, early memories I had of going to Jamaica or being around my family. So I don't think I decided that it was a novel till maybe I know after, it was a couple of years after I finished the program, maybe in 2008, 2009. And I don't think I've completely finished it till probably, I want to say 2018. I guess 2018 was probably when the book sold. But even after that, you know, even after you sell the book, you're going to keep making edits and changes. So I made actually a lot of changes even after that. So 12 years officially, maybe a little more if you count the edit period.
So when you first started writing, was it just supposed to be like individual short stories that were not linked?
Yeah. And the book really kept evolving over time. So initially it was just unrelated. You know, they're all related in that, you know, obviously they're based on me and my family. So they featured Jamaican people and, you know, so they were linked in that way geographically, but they weren't, it wasn't supposed to be the same family. And then I think after I graduated, I was still taking workshops occasionally, like non-credit workshops, and I was in a writing group, and I just had the idea that it would make more sense if I was writing about the same family. So, you know, I kind of made a major edit. I think at that point I had 4 or 5 stories. I kind of made a major edit where, you know, I'm going to rewrite this so that it's an interlinked short story collection and it's all the same family. And then over time, I think it was around the time, you know, my grandfather was coming down with early signs of dementia. You know, and I kind of realized that he was kind of a character in the stories. And so I had the idea of rewriting it to center around this one man and his kind of decision and have that be the inciting incident. So I kind of thought about the way that, you know, my grandfather and his life decisions are the reason why, you know, we're in America. I came because my grandfather had married somebody with a visa. And so I just thought of this kind of situation where that was more extreme than our real situation, obviously, where a character decides to fake his own death and start a new family. And I wanted to think about how that impacted the lives of everybody else in the novel, directly or indirectly. So I did another kind of major revision with that idea in mind.
I'm glad that you said that, you know, you of how the story came together, because I was reading it and I was just like, how did you put it all together? As someone who is finding her way through her own generational epic novel, which was not what I set out to do. And now, like, I had a part, and then I added all these other characters in their own separate stories, but I know they're all a part of the same family. And now I'm trying to put them all together. I read your book because I knew it had that kind of element. But as I was reading it, I was just like, how did she do this? So can you talk about the craft of and the decision making you did? And once you decided that, yes, it's going to be all one family, and then getting those inciting moments and putting them all together?
I didn't know what the final product was going to look like. I didn't know the arrangement of the stories when I started. But then when I realized that it was a novel, or decided that it was going to work toward either a novel or a novel in stories, I think the arrangement started to make sense as I wrote. Like, I didn't actually write each chapter in order, though. And it's interesting because when I started writing it, I was like 20, I don't know, it's like 24, I think, 24, 25. And so when I finished, I was in my like mid 30s. You know, so I had changed so much as a writer then. And it was such like a slog, you know, initially after I got out of the MFA, like staying motivated. But then when I kind of went back to it and decided to like finish it, it was fun. You know what I mean? So I think I started to see, the parallels with the book in my life kind of change toward the end. So I could kind of have more distance from it. And I think it was easier for the arrangement to kind of come into place. But I think once I decided to kind of think of it as the whole thing as like a ghost story, I think I kind of let that kind of theme dictate how the stories were going to be arranged. And then also, you know, I got really into genealogy, actually. And it was my agent. I didn't have a family tree when I started writing it and when I showed it to her. But before I finished it, she suggested making a family tree. And so my experience making that family tree changed the way that it was arranged, because I realized that, you know, by faking his own death, Abel had essentially created these two families that are technically are related, but don't know that they're related. So I had to figure out how to represent that and how it was going to make sense. And I think it mirrored my experience of learning things about my family. And I'm sure everybody who tries to research family who were formerly enslaved, you're going to have to take kind of indirect paths to kind of figure out or put the pieces together. And I think I wanted it to be representative of my real life efforts to kind of understand family and not so much like the way it's depicted in fiction. I think, you know, when you read family sagas, a lot of them, it's like this amazing detailed family tree going back, you know, generations. But I wanted there to be confusion and revision constantly, like, mm-hmm. you know, and so I wrote the stories thinking about that. You know, I want characters to be introduced, to be presented one way, and then you to kind of see this different view of them from the perspective of another family member. Or I want, like, you know, a character to who seems minor to actually have played like a major role, you know, in the direction of this family. So, yeah, I think the arrangement is messy because I think, you know, learning about and nonlinear because that's how we actually learn about our family history, especially if you're Black in the Western world. You know, you have to kind of put together like puzzle pieces.
Yeah, my mom is really into genealogy. And though I haven't made my own ancestry account, I've watched her over the years just gather all of this information and these different little tidbits, which has inspired my own writing. But I don't like the way it ends where I have my current stopping point as I'm revising. Once you had it together and you say you sold it in 2018, what was your publishing process like?
You know, I didn't really know, like, I think we know, you can read a lot about the you know, the surface level, but there was a lot about publishing I didn't know. Like, I didn't know how much, like, labor goes into it, like, from other people. Yes, and just, there's just a lot of editing, a lot of passes, you know, where you have to read your novel, and then they employ the changes, and then you read it again, and you read it again, and you're talking to marketing, and you're talking to copy editors, and you know, I didn't know. And then the promotion aspect of it too is very intense. And also, I think before then I'd only published either short stories or like essays, personal essays. And you know, I've gotten feedback from editors and suggestions, but I've never had to edit, you know, like a 300 page book. And that was very intense. It took me like a lot of psychological preparation. Like, you know, I got my edits back, but I think it was like 2 months before I could really even begin to kind of dive into them because I was just so overwhelmed and a bit intimidated. But I think that's something to prepare for. It's that even when you think you're done, you're really not done. There's so many changes that you have to prepare to do to the book after it's sold. And it's just like an ongoing process. And even like, you know, I don't think I made any changes, but even when I went to paperback, they're like, do you want to make any changes? And I just like mentally couldn't, but it's like, now I'm like, I could see several changes I could have made. So maybe the next edition, but yeah. And I think I had read an interview with like Tobias Wolff where he said something like that, how he's kept editing Bullet in the Brain over time. Like it doesn't stop once published. You can still make changes.
Robert Jones Jr. said that about The Prophets when I interviewed him, that, you know, he basically said that, you know, the book had to be wrestled away from him so that he would stop revising it. But even now that it's out and people are reading it, if he goes to reread it, he sees things that he wants to cut or shorten or tweak or make more clear or simplify or things like that.
So yeah, it's funny. Robert and I were in the same MFA program.
Well, that's why I wanted to talk to you, because I remember him talking about your book on an Instagram Live. And I was like, well, let me go see what this is about. And then I read it and I was like, ooh. I wasn't sure if you guys were in the same class or not, but that's cool to know.
Yeah, we were. Yeah.
You had mentioned earlier that, like, once you were able to put some distance between your personal story and the fiction, that it became fun for you. In all of the revisions that you did it stop being fun and then start to feel like work?
Well, definitely, you know, after it sold and the editing, that was definitely work. Because there's no way to know, you know, how somebody else is going to receive it. Especially if you've been sitting with it for years and years and years, it's almost like when you know a book is finished, it's like when you literally know that this is the best I can do. I cannot, you know, write anymore. So by the time I sold it, I thought that this was all I can do. And then you have this other person come in and say, no, you can do this and this and this. Yeah. So that was work to kind of like push myself to keep changing it beyond what I thought was possible. And actually, but I was grateful for that, because when I sold the book, I think it was like the word count was in the 60s, but by the time we went through the editorial process, it was over 90,000 words. So I added like about 30,000 words and made a lot of drastic changes that I think improved it. But yeah, it's definitely work to keep looking at something when you're like done with it and you want to be free of it.
How does it feel? And I don't know if I'm going to word this question right, but how does it feel mentally, emotionally, to be stretched in that way in your creativity, and to have people see that they can get more out of you to make the art better?
It's difficult while you're doing it, but afterwards, I mean, it always feels amazing as a writer, for me at least, to read something and to be like surprised that it came from me. I think that's one of the best moments in you know, being a writer. Is like, I don't know, like you literally don't know where it came from. And I think I have a difficult time reading this book anymore. But when I do go back to it, you know, it's like I can't even go to the place anymore where I wrote these words. So it almost feels like it's outside of yourself. And that's kind of a magical feeling sometimes.
Does it feel like that part of your life has been excised from you and freed you up to write something else?
It's starting to feel that. It took a while because I'm under contract for a second book. So I have been working on another book since it's been published, but it almost like I felt like I still had these other characters in my head. So it was very hard for me to really get invested. It took a long time for me to get invested in the other work. And actually I put that other work to the side and I'm writing a new book now, but yeah, it does when you sit with characters for that long, it really takes a while to push them out of your head.
All right, so then let's do the reading, because I have my absolute favorite part of the book that I want to talk about. So if you want to read a little section, and then we can talk about the book specifically and the characters and their shenanigans and all of the things.
Okay, sure.
Black and Published family, it's time for the reading. Maisie Card's debut novel, These Ghosts Are Family, tells the story of the people left behind after one man faked his death and stole the identity of his best friend. Hurtling between past and present, and covering ground from Jamaica to London to Brooklyn, the novel combines the tropes of horror with the puzzling work of genealogy to create a narrative that is a haunting history of what it means to be family. Here's Maisie.
So the first chapter is called The True Death of Abel Paisley. Let's say that you are a 69-year-old Jamaican man called Stanford, or Stan for short, who once faked your own death. Though you have never used those words to describe what you did, at the time you thought of it as seizing an opportunity placed before you by God. But since your wife Adele died a month ago, you've convinced yourself her heart attack was retribution for your sin. So today you have gathered three of your female descendants in one house, even the daughter who you thought was dead all these years, and decided that you will finally tell them the truth. You are not who you say you are. You have spent the last 20 years of your second life living in a brownstone in Harlem, running a West Indian grocery store. Recently, you shuttered the store. You have given up on fighting your arthritis pain and are finally sitting in the wheelchair Adele picked out. You are looking out of your parlor window, waiting for your daughter, the one who thinks you are dead, to arrive. It's been 35 years since you've seen her, so you study each woman who passes your house for reflections of yourself. You haven't bothered to shave, press your clothes, or comb your hair. You are ready to be still and rot. You imagine the death of Stanford Solomon, unlike the abrupt end of Abel Paisley, will be achingly slow. Already it feels like you are losing small pieces of yourself daily. To you, old age is a torture you deserve. A slow, insignificant death, your matter dispersing into the air like dandelion seeds until the day there's nothing left. When you died the first time, you were still a young man in your 30s and it had been working in England for less than a year. It wasn't easy for an immigrant, especially a Black man, to find a decent job back then. But through a boy you'd known back in primary school, Stanford, you'd gotten a room and a job on a ship. You had no idea it was just the beginning of your streak of good luck. You and Stanford were the chosen wogs they allowed to work alongside the white men. Stanford complained often about London. He hated the cold. He missed his grandmother and the tiny village, Harrowtown, where you'd both grown up back in Jamaica. You'd already escaped the countryside for Kingston, and from there, London. You felt free. That sense of freedom and joy only dampened when you thought of the family you left behind. Your first wife, Vera, wrote you long letters weekly about how you'd abandoned her and left her to become a dried-up old spinster. But you both knew perfectly well that it was her idea for you to go to England, where she thought you'd somehow become a better provider. Your son, Vincent, was still in Vera's womb when you sailed off. Your daughter, Irene, a stumbling toddler, you had barely settled in when Vera's first letter arrived with a list of things she wanted you to buy and send them. With every letter, the list grew longer, and you worried that you would never be enough. The day you died, you were running alongside the dock because you were late for work while a container was being lowered onto the ship. You stopped short when the container fell, dropped from the crane, and thundered against the deck. You were close enough to hear the screaming. "Who was it?" you heard someone shout. "One of the wogs," another answered. "It's Abel." For a moment, you were confused, hearing yourself pronounced dead. It was like one of those movies where the dead person's spirit stands by watching as a crowd gathers around his body. But no, you were certain it wasn't your body, so you boarded the ship. The captain approached you immediately and said, "I'm sorry, mate. No way Abel could have survived that." You almost laugh now when you think of it. The one time racism worked in your favor. The captain had gotten his wogs confused, looked you right in the eye, and mistaken you for the other Black guy. Abel was crushed under the container, unrecognizable. But you, Stanford now, could turn and go home.
Thank you. So I think my favorite character in the book is Vera, especially when we get to the exorcism and she tells Bernard that his balls have been dropped, but he want to wrestle with the devil. Mm-hmm. I think I read that line like 4 or 5 times. One, because it was in patois and I loved it so, so much. What was it like when you are Jamaican, so you speak patois?
Yeah, I mean, I did when I was younger. But, you know, me and my family kind of got into the habit that, you know, because when we came here, my mother like corrected our English a lot because she wanted us to blend in. So I, you know, my family speaks to me in patois, but I just talk like this now. But, you know, I'm familiar with those voices. Those are voices that I hear in my head, but it's not necessarily how I like talk to my family anymore.
Okay, because I love the incorporation of it. And so then it just became normal for me reading it and hearing it that way, having been to Jamaica. What was the reception like when you, as you included that in the novel?
I started writing this a long time ago, but I finished at a very fortunate time because I think a lot of Jamaican writers had come out since and been published by, you know, the big publishers by the time I finished writing it. So, you know, when I started, I don't know if Marlon James' first book was out. I know it came out while I was in grad school because I wrote a paper on it. But you know, since then he's huge and there are a lot of Jamaican writers, and Alexia Arthur is actually, her book published, I think, you know, just after I sold this, How to Love a Jamaican, which is a short story collection. So, you know, there were more mainstream books that incorporate a lot of patois that had already been published. So I didn't really have much difficulty like getting this through.
I remember after reading Marlon James's The Book of Night Women and how he would have them answer me, no, no. I think I said that out loud, like to somebody after reading it, because I was so used to reading it. I was like, oop, I've been reading the book. Like, don't mind me. In incorporating some of the Jamaican folklore, especially about the ghosts, was that something that you grew up with or was that something that you had to research?
It's definitely something I grew up with. You know, I think whether or not, I don't even think we ever really talked about like whether we would hear ghost stories. People would tell stories. My uncles would talk about seeing ghosts. My mother would tell me stories about like, you know, my uncle seeing a ghost, like knock my grandmother over when, you know, when they're little. And it's not, you know, we never talk about whether it happened or not happened. You just tell the story. And I think I just got used to constantly hearing these ghost stories and also just these kind of superstitious practices that you do because you're afraid of ghosts, you know? I think it's this third chapter, gratitude, you know, which is about the nine night rituals. And that was, you know, that was all based on what I remember of my grandmothers, their nine nights, you know, and just like the idea that you have to do all these things so the spirit, you know, doesn't stay, the duppy doesn't stay and haunt you. And, you know, I just got used to kind of those things. I think it's just like a part of the culture that can't really be filtered out. So as I was writing, it felt natural to incorporate that stuff. But then I also thought about how much I really like horror movies, which I really do. And so I kind of played it up more, and I decided that was going to be like the kind of connecting thread of all the stories, was that they would each kind of represent a different trope, you know, from a horror movie.
Ooh, what are the horror movie tropes? I don't think I know them because I'm not.
I don't know if tropes are right, but you know, like the exorcism. You know, there's a point where there's demonic possession, but there's also the story past lives, where the character kind of for a moment she feels like possessed by her mother. There's the first story where there is an actual ghost as a character. There's the end, which, you know, the last chapter, which is a different kind of folklore, has this character, you know, called the Old Hag, but you could think of it as like the Old Hag story in a lot of folklore, or a vampire story. And it kind of, she's kind of like a blend between a witch and a vampire. So, yeah, there's a couple places where that comes out. And then there's also the haunted object, you know, with the, I can't even remember the name of my own chapters, but the Debbie character with the book that she feels like is haunted, by her ancestor. So in little ways, I think in every chapter, I try to have the character kind of literally or figuratively haunted by something.
Yes. I was going to ask about Debbie and the diary, the Harold's diary. Did you have to do like intense, like artifact research to get the history of like Jamaica and the plantations there? Because was so visceral.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It just so happened that I like reading that stuff. So I had just, I didn't set out to do research for this book. I was just reading about Jamaican history. And so when I got to the later chapters or the sections that I would write later, you know, I realized that I had done all this research, and it, you know, it changed my perception of, you know, how I saw Jamaica and how I saw my own family in the context of history. And so I kind of wanted to put that in. So then, yes, at some points I did do even more, just to make sure that it was accurate. But, you know, I had been reading about Thomas Thistlewood, who's a Jamaican plantation owner who actually kept a diary, extensive diaries, I think over the course of 28 years. And it gave like a detailed, account of how he treated his slaves, like horribly, you know, and all the beatings and the sexual assaults. And so, you know, I read different historians have written about him and, you know, excerpted different portions of his diary. So yeah, I did reread his books while I was writing this. And I know that Marlon James had mentioned that was a source he consulted for, you know, the Book of Night Women too.
I just finished reading and interviewing Lisa Williamson Rosenberg, who wrote Embers on the Wind, and her book has some of those kind of ghost stories. Well, it is about a ghost, and it does travel through slavery and has some similar themes. And she talked about how, you know, it wouldn't leave her alone, the idea and the thought of basically the inspiration. You've talked about, like, it's been hard to excise yourself away from this story. Do you do anything to protect yourself from the subject matter that you're writing about? Because I feel like it can become all consuming.
I probably didn't do enough. because yeah, it does become all consuming. And you know, it's like, I'm already kind of superstitious. So I think a lot of things happened after I wrote the book, and I was telling friends, and they're like, yeah, you can't write things like that down. And so it feels like, yeah, it feels very spooky. Like there's a lot of things about that I haven't talked about that happened that were very like spooky. But
now I want to know, like, what if you mind, if you don't mind sharing.
I mean, and it's all you know, it's all like magical thinking, you know. But you know, like I think the Abel Paisley character in my mind was based on my grandfather, and I wrote it knowing, like, thinking of my grandfather's mortality and thinking of, like, you know, that there was all this unresolved things that people in my family wanted to say to him. And all these things that he had to really account for or atone for, that he probably never would. And so I think in the character Abel, I was like, what can I do to him? You know, what can I do to him? What's like a punishment? Mm. And I thought, like, I think in the book, one of the things that happens is that, you know, for me, for my family, and I think for a lot of Caribbean families, like, the, you know, how you're buried matters so much. Like, my mother still, she's always talking about her funeral and, like, what we have to do. And I always thought that my grandfather, since he has so many children and since he's impacted so many people, that he would have this massive, you know, nine night, and, like, you know, whether or not people had hard feelings, like, everybody would come out and kind of celebrate him. And so in the book, I was like, you know, I'm going to have the character be cremated. Abel won't get that kind of send off that he expects. He's going to be, and it's obviously lots of cultures do that, and it's not a big deal. But I think in the context of my family, I think that that's a difficult thing. So I made the character be cremated as a sort of punishment. And then, you know, after I wrote the book, my grandfather passed away and he was cremated because you know, he passed away during COVID. And it's just something that, and it's obviously, it's not related. A lot of people were cremated, but it's just something that, it was a weird parallel that happened after, you know, after the book was published.
I get that. With my family being from New Orleans, you know, there's a big emphasis on how you die and how you're celebrated in your death. And so, and I feel like I've heard somewhere that, you know, some people live for their homegoing celebration.
Yeah.
And because it is a big deal, the send off and everything like that. So I can see definitely how that happens. When you say that you're working on something else now, but when you finished this book and knew that it was done and sent it out in the world, what did you want readers to get from it?
I think I wanted readers to read it and kind of think about their own families. I think, you know, I wrote it because I had a lot of frustration. I had, like, you know, I sensed that there were a lot of things that I had not said to my family, I had not said to my parents, and that I didn't really think I ever would. And I think that they would never say to me. And I think, you know, I think some people, when they read the book, will say, like, oh, well, have you had these conversations? And I'm like, no, that's not how we operate. But, you know, I wrote this to say it in the way that I could say, you know, say these things. But I think I have heard from other people who say that this has opened the door to conversations with their family, you know, and I think that's what I wanted the people kind of think about. Think about their family history. Think about, like, whether or not it's pretty, you know, to kind of save that, because once it's gone, like, once that knowledge is gone, it's gone. And it's very hard to recover. It's very hard to, like, put the pieces back together. So I think I just wanted people to think about their own situation, read it and think about their own situations.
So has your family read the book?
My brother and my sister and a couple of my aunts, I think. My parents, they were like, oh, I read it. But I think they just kind of flipped through the first couple of pages. They don't really read fiction, so I really don't think they've read it at all.
Okay. And so you said you're working on something else. So what else can we expect from Maisie Card?
I'm working on another novel. This one I think it's similar in subject matter, like, and characters, but I think it's set more in the United States than Jamaica. And it's kind of, I don't know how to give away the plot, but it's just set in library. It's set in, like, libraries. I'm a librarian. So.
Oh, so you work, cause you work at the New Jersey Public Library. Yes.
I worked at the Newark Public Library. Yeah.
Okay.
And I'm working at a school, but, yeah, it's just kind of a little bit of my experience working in urban public libraries. But it also has the same theme of, like, family drama.
Ooh. All right. So I want to switch to the speed round and a little game before I let you go for the afternoon. So first question, what is your favorite book?
I think Toni Morrison's A Mercy. That's the book I go to when I'm like stumped and I need to feel creative. But I also like Leslie Necker Rima's What It Means When a Man Falls from the Sky. That's a new favorite.
Who is your favorite author?
Oh, that's hard. I'll say Toni Morrison again.
And since you mentioned you love horror movies, what's your favorite horror movie?
Maybe 28 Days Later. That's a zombie movie. Let the Right One In.
Okay, okay.
Which is a vampire movie.
I probably could do vampires. We'll see. And then what's a book that makes you want to burn your notebook, like what Nina Mosley said in Love Jones, or like, you know, you read something, you're like, I could never do that. I'm retiring from writing.
Maybe Luster.
Raven Leilani?
Yeah, it was just so, yeah, it just was so funny. And just like on the sentence level, like I just felt like every sentence was so well-written and interesting.
And then what do you think is the best book to movie adaptation?
Ooh, I feel like my mind always goes blank. I feel like the last one I saw was like Normal People by Sally Rooney. I mean, the TV show. I don't know if that's the best, but that's just the last one I could think of. Oh, maybe The Color Purple, I think. Actually, The Color Purple. Yeah.
And then if money were no option, where would you go? What would you do? And where would you live?
I'm like very boring. I'm not a big traveler. I like to like stick with what I know. But I don't know. I mean, I grew up in New York and I got priced out. I would be like between Jamaica and Brooklyn, probably. I actually want to I'm trying to figure out like where some of my grandfather's like ancestral land is in Jamaica. And I think I would probably want to buy back that property because there are graves there. Yeah. And I'd probably just like build a house in that area.
All right. So my game is called Rewriting the Classics. Let's see how far we get. What's the one book you wish you would have written?
I would say Homegoing, actually. I think that's like a perfect book.
Name one book where you want to change the ending and how would you do it?
I'm just thinking about The Color Purple because I've mentioned it before, but I think one of the things that make me saddest about that is, I love the ending, but then, you know, it's Celie doesn't get reunited with her sister till the end. I would probably just like change the ending so that she somehow found her sister a little earlier.
And then name one book that you think is overrated or overtaught and why?
Ooh, that's tough. Nobody's going to agree, but I just, growing up, you know, when we were assigned in school, I just couldn't read any Jane Austen novel. I just can't. I've just never been able to finish any single Jane Austen novel, but I'm sure I know she's brilliant, but I just can't.
That's the Pride and the Prejudice and all of those.
Yeah, yeah. Sense and Sensibility. We're assigned, like, I think all of them in high school, but I just could never get through a single one.
I never read any Jane Austen. I've had people that have loved her, and I've people have been like, oh, I don't get it. I can't. I've never read Jane Austen, nor have I seen the movies.
Yeah, I think, I don't even think I've gotten through the movies. Yeah, I just can't. But I'm not a romance person, so maybe that's why.
All right, and so my final question for you today, when you are among your ancestors, what would you like someone to write about you and the legacy of words and work that you left behind?
You know, I think every family has like the family historian. I think I kind of want to be seen that way. And hopefully I can be like, I'm really trying hard to kind of, piece together like the puzzle of our family. So I hope that I'm able to do it.
Thank you, Maisie.
Thank you.
Big thank you to Maisie Card for being here today on Black and Published. Make sure you check out Maisie's debut novel, These Ghosts Are Family, out now from Simon & Schuster. And if you're not following Maisie, follow her on the socials. She's at Library Love Fest on Instagram. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Maisie about what keeps her from confronting her family about the issues she's written about in her book. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holler at y'all next week when our guest will be Mateo Ascarapor, author of the novel Black Buck.
Older people, especially older Black folk, I'll talk to them and they'll say, now, Mateo, I didn't know about your book. When I read Black Buck, I said, what is this?
That's but, how I felt.
Yeah, but I was like, yeah, but
I don't know.
But either someone told me just to do it, or something told me to do it, and when I got it, and I realize what you were doing, and I'm with it. But that title, so there's been people like that. So this is all to say that none of my intentions were to unnecessarily provoke.
That's next week on Black and Published. I'll talk to you then. Peace.